Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, covering topics of interest to lawyers handling civil appellate matters in Texas courts. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the Texas appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
We have as our guest today, Kent Rutter. Kent is a partner at Haynes & Boone, and he's a very experienced appellate practitioner, bar leader, and author, and CLE speaker. I think, does that pretty much cover it, Kent?
You're very kind. Thanks for having me.
I've known you, Kent, for quite some time. I've been involved in some of the same organizations that you have. My path in those organizations has turned out a little differently than yours. If I understand correctly, you're the current chair of the State Bar Appellate Section, right?
Right.
And then I think I mentioned you're a partner at Haynes & Boone. How long have you been at Haynes & Boone now?
My entire career. I was there my 2L summer in law school, and I've been there ever since then. So I am in my 24th year at Haynes & Boone.
Well, you look way too young to be 24 years in one place. But that's my perspective. Everyone looks young to me these days. So tell us, I mean, what led you to Haynes & Boone? Where did you go to school and where'd you grow up and how did you wind up at Haynes & Boone?
Sure. Well, I grew up mostly in a smallish town in the Midwest called Normal, Illinois. And I didn't have any lawyers in my family, but my mom, before she retired, worked for the office of the state of Illinois that published the official court reporters for the Illinois appellate courts. And even though she didn't have a law degree, her job was to be an editor of opinions before they were issued. So the appellate courts in Illinois would send their draft opinions to this office, and my mom and other people there would mark them up and say, this sentence isn't grammatically correct, this logic doesn't seem to flow, and then they would send them back to the author, and the author, of course, could choose to accept or reject the changes, and then they'd be published in the official reporters. So I thought that was kind of a cool job, and I think that's how I first got the idea of appellate practice in my head.
Wow. We probably could all take a page from that book and have somebody who's not a lawyer read our briefing and make sure it actually makes sense and the logic follows.
Yeah, I think it helps. And she got to be. She did that for many, many years. And because she read just about every opinion issued by every court of appeals in the state of Illinois, she was kind of a walking encyclopedia of Illinois law.
Oh, I bet.
I bet. So how did you get to Haynes & Boone?
So in law school, we had our first year research and writing class, and everyone in my group just absolutely hated it. And I thought it was the greatest thing. And we got to write a brief, and I won the award for the best brief. And I thought, this is really great. I need to do something like this for a living. And so I read a lot of legal publications on Westlaw and figured out that Texas would be a really good place to start a career as an appellate lawyer. I read about Lynn Liberato in some of these articles, and I thought, gosh, I'd really like to work with her. And I was lucky enough to get a job there in my 2L summer of 95.
Wow. Well, tell us about your practice. I know we generally invite folks on the show who have a connection to Texas appellate law, and you know, we've already kind of touched upon the fact that you do, but what do you do day in, day out in your practice at Haynes & Boone?
Well, one of the things that drew me to Haynes & Boone is that it really was at the time, and to an extent still is, a very rare example of sort of an appellate boutique within the context of a large firm. So Haynes & Boone currently have 7 full-time appellate lawyers in Houston, about 20 full-time appellate lawyers across the firm. And so Obviously, we are sometimes working with our own litigators, but for the most part, the cases that I handle on appeal or the trial lawyers I work with come from trial counsel who are outside my firm. And even more than most appellate lawyers, I really get to do a little bit of everything. The three cases on my front burner right now involve a commercial lending dispute, a train crash, and a plane crash. So it's a little bit of everything, and I just love that about my practice.
That's really an incredible size practice group in this day and age. I mean, from having observed the market, that seems like, I don't want to call Haynes & Boone an outlier, but it seems like most of the bigger firms have trimmed away at the size of their appellate practice groups over the last 10 or 15 years. And yet you all are 20-something lawyers across the firm. That's incredible.
Yeah, it's really remarkable, and I think it speaks volume to the founders of our appellate group that they were able to establish our group and maintain it through all of these years. It's really nice to have other appellate lawyers down the hall that I can bounce ideas off of. Lynn, of course, Mark Trachtenberg, Christina Crozier, Polly Pahn, and be able to do that, but also to have the resources of a larger firm. So it's been a good fit for me.
We also mentioned briefly that you were the chair of the appellate section of the state bar. You want to talk to us a little about what's going on with that and how that impacts your practice?
Sure. Well, both of you have labored in the trenches of the state bar appellate section for many years together. I can't remember exactly what years y'all got involved. I think I got involved in 2008. When the chair at the time, Daryl Moore, now Judge Daryl Moore, more or less volunteered me to help the section conduct a survey of the appellate judiciary to ask them about their preferences, likes, dislikes, that sort of thing, with Scott Rothenberg and Joanne Story. And essentially, they provided the wisdom behind the survey, and I was the IT guy who knew how to do an online survey. And we did that survey. The first time was published in 2010, the second time in 2015, and the third version of the survey is coming out this year. And ever since then, for the last 12 years, I've served in a number of roles and had a chance to work with both of you, among other people. And it's just a wonderful group. I love the State Bar Appellate Section. We've moved into large section territory. We have more than 2,000 members.
Really, I would not have thought it was that big.
Yeah, 2,000 members, 26 active committees, and a roster of about 75 appellate lawyers and judges who are at any given time actively involved, either as an officer, a council member, or doing work on one of those committees. So it's a big effort and a lot of really smart, really good people doing a lot of good work all around the state.
Since we're talking about the state bar section, I'm going to go ahead and put a plug in for the Appellate Advocate. I'm one of the co-managing editors. It's a great publication, and it's a benefit that you get if you join the state bar appellate section. For how much is it a year? It's not that much.
$25.
So you get that. It is published usually quarterly, depending on the editors, and I take the blame for some that didn't make it quarterly, but it's full of great stuff, lead articles. It's got summaries from all the relevant courts of appeals, both federal and state that are in Texas. Got all kinds of awesome features and really good stuff in there. And then there's some other benefits. I don't want to put you on the spot, but I know I saw an ad the other day about the forms that are available on the section website. I know that there's free online CLE and some other stuff that you get for the low, low cost of only $25 a year.
So many benefits. Todd, you were an advocate editor as well, right?
I was. In fact, I was the last editor of the non-digital version. After I wrapped up, I handed the reins off to Dylan Drummond and Brandy Voss. I think Dylan may have had a lot to do with taking the publication digital, although there was some movement even back at that time. And we're talking about, you know, going on 10 years ago now. So I was, and that was a really great experience for me. When I first got involved with the Appellate Advocate and the Appellate Section, I was a younger lawyer kind of trying to get in and start getting to know people. And, you know, my experience with the section, Kent, is just like yours. I found it. I made so many friends working with that group. people who are friends to this day, and you know, people who show up opposite me in cases, and we have a great time being against each other. And I actually, I've not been involved in the section for quite a while, and I really miss it because there's a lot of camaraderie that comes out of that group and a lot there of important work.
And I'm really happy to hear you say that. That really feel that the bar work I've done with the appellate section, I think it's made me a better appellate lawyer. I know it's absolutely made me a happier appellate lawyer, just being plugged into a community of people who have the same interests, the same somewhat nerdy tendencies that I do, and just an awesome group of people. And the benefits, I like to point out to people that membership is $25 a year. One of the benefits that you get is $50 off of the advanced appellate course. So sort of like when oil went below $0 a barrel, that's sort of where the appellate section is. It's almost like we pay you to join. But the benefits, awesome. Of course, advanced appellate, which we help plan. There's the appellate advocate, which is a really important journal for appellate practitioners to keep up with in Texas. Members can access free online CLE, which is even more important these days than ever to meet your CLE requirements. And this is top-notch CLE. The offerings include currently presentations by several of the justices on the Texas Supreme Court. I believe we have Chief Justice Hecht, Justice Busby, and Justice Blacklock are all presenters of some of our current online CLE offerings. When you watch them, then you can report it for MCLE credit. A number of the offerings qualify for ethics credit as well, so that's a big one. We also host various social events with courts of appeals. We've done them with most of the courts of appeals around the state, and so it's a good opportunity for practitioners to get to know their appellate judges in a less terrifying setting than oral argument. And the list really goes on. And so many opportunities to do good work. A lot of people don't know that the section essentially operates the pro bono programs for a number of the courts of appeals around the state. I'm really proud of the work that we've been doing on diversity, that the appellate bar in Texas has a huge challenge when it comes to diversity. And our section is really trying to do something about that, including focusing on the pipeline for future appellate practitioners in the law schools. So just a lot of good work and a lot of good people doing that work. So I would definitely encourage everyone who's interested in getting involved to drop me a line. We always have work to be done on committees and would love to get people involved.
Well, I can vouch for the organization being a great way for someone who's really interested in appellate practice and wants to make it their practice. It's a great way to get plugged into that and meet so many people that you wouldn't otherwise. So that's great to hear. And you mentioned the pro bono program. I think we're probably going to need to do a whole episode on the pro bono program. So we'll probably wind up doing that because it's definitely worth spending some time, you know, exploring in depth as far as how that works and the benefits that it mm-hmm. brings to young lawyers who are trying to get oral argument experience, for example. Let's turn to the new article, or it's not really new, it's updated, right?
Right. This is the third edition. We've done this article three times now, Reasons for Reversal. And one of the nice things about that is that we can now talk about how the courts of appeals are evolving over the last 20 years or so. So for older folks like me, that's a topic of interest, but it's always useful for everyone to have a snapshot of showing objectively and empirically what's going on in the courts of appeals.
This was quite an undertaking. Do you kind of feel like your mom having read every published appellate opinion in the state of Texas over a period of time?
It's a great question. They do say we become our parents.
And so just so everyone can find it, the article is the Law Review article version of this is published in the Houston Law Review. It looks like it's volume 57 of the Houston Law Review here in 2020. You've been doing some CLE speaking on this, though. So there's some other versions, I take it, like out on Texas Bar CLE and so forth, that covered the same ground.
That's right. We do, in a CLE presentation, we can only cover really a very narrow slice of the complete study in any given CLE presentation. And so, for example, we presented it from an appellate standpoint, an advanced appellate. I'll speak to different groups along with my co-author, Natasha Breaux, or sometimes with a member of the judiciary focusing on a particular type of case, for example, tort cases, or a particular court of appeals. So I was up in Fort Worth, and Justice Kerr and I gave a presentation that focused specifically on the Fort Worth Court of Appeals. And for me, I always find it terrifically interesting to hear straight from someone on the court why the reversals look like they do.
or that they don't know why. They just decide the cases. I think that was Justice Kerr's point, is she just kind of decides the cases the way that she does and was interested to see how they came out.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, the idea of, I think you described it as a study, and then the other word that popped into my brain is data. You know, other than what we see out of the Office of Court Administration, which I think you guys go far beyond, and you look at data coming out of the Courts of Appeals in a much different way than what the OCA data shows. But the idea of a study or data coming out on an appellate issue is sort of interesting. Can you tell us a little about the methodology that you all used in coming up with the data that you relied on in preparing the article?
Sure. So as you mentioned, the first step is to get our hands on every single civil appeal that's decided by the 14 intermediate courts of appeals during a court fiscal year, which runs from September 1st through August 31st. And then over the course of the year, we read each of those opinions. And then the way it works is we have an Excel spreadsheet that we categorize the opinion according to what court it was, whether it was affirmed or reversed, what type of case it was. In other words, was it a PI case? Was it a business tort, a contract, insurance coverage, et cetera? Then we also track how it was decided by the trial court. In other words, was it a jury trial, a bench trial, a summary judgment, some combination of those, a special appearance, a plea to the jurisdiction, arbitration, et cetera? When we're done, we have a spreadsheet with about 1,800 cases on it that we can then sort in a bunch of different ways to slice and dice the data and answer very specific questions like, what is the reversal rate in the first court of appeals for summary judgments in contract cases? And then when we look at the reversals, we can answer questions like, when there's a reversal of a jury verdict, is it more likely or more frequent that the verdict will get set aside based on the insufficiency of the evidence or because there was an error in the jury charge? Questions like that. So we can come up with all sorts of empirical numbers to show what is and isn't likely to lead to reversal in the courts of appeals. And some of it, I think, confirms what appellate practitioners already know, but trial counsel often don't. And then some of it really comes out of the blue and is a surprise to everyone. And that's the fun stuff for us.
Yeah.
So you did the cases from August of 2018 to August of 2019. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And this turned out to be really an odd year because when we started doing this, we had no idea when we started doing this on September 1st of 2018. That the courts of appeals in Austin, Dallas, and the 1st and 14th in Houston were all going to go from being all Republican courts to majority Democratic courts right when we were a third of the way through our survey year. At least I did not know that was going to happen when we started the court year. So it turned out to be really an exceptional and I think a really interesting year to study.
And I know that you mentioned kind of briefly at the advanced appellate CLE that y'all were still digesting some of that. Were you able to pick out, going back, looking at the data, any trends as those courts that turned over or anything of note, or is it still just not really enough data to come up with conclusions about how the turnover might have affected reversal rates?
I try to, when I talk about the turnover, I try to be careful to sound a note of caution that even though those are big courts, there's lots of appeals, both in the period before the turnover and the period after the turnover. you're still looking at relatively short periods of time. So 4 months before the turnover and 8 months after the turnover. So whether the data that we have is really indicative of what these courts are going to do going forward, I don't know. Maybe it's a perfect indication, maybe it's not. But I do think that there are some really interesting lessons. One, I think it's clear that at least in the year that we studied, there's no doubt that in tort cases, plaintiffs did much better on appeal after January of 2020 when the new courts took effect. What we've been able to do after we've had some time to really dig into the data is to figure out why that is. And there were, to me, a couple of really interesting lessons. The first is that when we dug through the data, it became really clear to me that it's not as simple as saying Democratic judges prefer to rule in favor of plaintiffs and Republican judges prefer to rule in favor of defendants. When you look at the data, what's actually going on is that the new justices are much less likely to set aside a jury verdict, regardless of what the type of case is, regardless of who prevailed. And so what you're seeing is a difference in philosophy that's procedurally related, not related to the nature of who the party is, whether they're a plaintiff or a defendant or an individual or a corporation. I also learned a really interesting lesson in Fort Worth, actually, that one of the surprising statistics originally when we did the study, and it's great fun when Natasha, my co-author, and I are running the data at the very end, and one of us will run into the other one's office and say, "Oh my gosh, can you believe what this reversal rate is?" I'm not sure what that says about us, but this is one that really stood out to us, was that around the state, the Court of Appeals that is least likely to reverse a summary judgment is the 13th Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi. And the Court of Appeals that is most likely to reverse a summary judgment is the 2nd Court of Appeals in Fort Worth. And so if your assumption is that Democrats are hostile to summary judgments and Republicans like summary judgments, that kind of throws a big question mark.
Turns it on its head. Logic. Yeah,
yes.
Absolutely.
So, you know, of course, this is when Natasha and I like to put on our detective hats and get our magnifying glasses and try to figure out what it is. And where my mind went was, okay, so maybe this isn't a reflection on the partisanship of the appellate judges, but maybe it's a reflection on the partisanship of the trial judges. So maybe if trial judges in the Valley don't grant many summary judgments and they only grant a summary judgment to put extremely weak cases out of their misery, then it might make sense that those summary judgments are rarely getting reversed, and the opposite could be true in Fort Worth. Mm-hmm. So we dug into the trial court data, which we can do thanks to the OCA, and it turns out that no, actually, judges in the Valley grant summary judgment about as often as judges in Fort Worth do. So I was stumped. I could not find my partisan explanation. And I was speaking to a group of plaintiff's lawyers in Fort Worth, and I asked them what they thought the answer was. And they looked at me like I was crazy to ask the question. And finally, one of them said, "Well, you know, they're Republicans, but they're perfectly capable of recognizing a fact issue when they see one." And I think that's absolutely, you know, I think that's absolutely right. So one of the lessons of this study, I think, is certainly the study shows that elections do make a difference. But when you dig into the numbers, they don't always make a difference in the ways you expect or for the reasons those of us who think in political terms might expect.
You know, another lesson that I'm hearing is that people who are seeking summary judgment in Fort Worth really ought to consult a Fort Worth appellate lawyer and maybe hire them to help out with their briefing. I feel like that's probably a good lesson to take from this.
Absolutely. You know, Justice Kerr made that exact point. And
well, we don't think, of course, that that's limited to Fort Worth by any means.
No, not at all. But since we're talking about the Fort Worth court, I'll just throw that out there.
Absolutely.
Just as a tip.
In my practice overall, I kind of distill clients' questions down to three basic questions when they're coming in and talking to me about the possible appeal. You know, one is, how much is this going to cost me? The second is, how long is it going to take? And the third is, what are my chances? And to me, this article really helps, you know, peel the layers back on what the chances are. And of course, you know, you have to be careful in advising clients. I always preface it by saying, well, according to this Rudder guy, or really what I say is, you know, well, the statistics are this. And the article really is, you know, you can't help but, because you can distill these patterns out, you can't help but use it as a predictive tool to some degree. So, you know, is that going on within the walls of Haynes and Boone? Are y'all, you know, giving a copy of this to your clients and saying, this is what we think, this is what we observe, and in your case, this is where you fall? And because you've done a tremendous amount of work here. I mean, it's just fascinating, just a load of work to distill these patterns out. And so it seems like the real value is in being able to use it for that purpose, to advise clients about, you know, how to go about their appeal or whether to appeal their particular kind of case.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the main reasons to refer to this article, and I certainly use it in that way. And in fact, one of the things that I've told Haynes and Boone is that, sure, I'm going to spend many, many hours working on this study instead of billing time. But one of the advantages is that not all of the data can be squeezed into a law review article. And so we do have the advantage that we have the entire set of data and we can run even more granular findings than you could find in the law review article. But for anyone, I think we all have the experience where in that initial phone conversation, when someone calls you up and they say, you know, what are my chances? And to me, the way to use this article, I don't think it provides the complete answer, but I think it provides a starting point. So you can say, this is what the reversal rate seems to be in similar types of cases. And then after looking at the record, I think the chances in this appeal are hopefully higher or perhaps lower for these reasons. And in my experience, clients understand that you can't predict the future, but they like to know that there's something underlying your estimate other than that we've handled a lot of appeals and we have a good feeling or maybe a bad feeling about this particular one. They like to know that there's a little bit of objective data going into the analysis.
I like having your article, and I also find myself using Pam Barron's Texas Supreme Court statistics very much in the same way that, you know, in a typical case, this is what the numbers tell us. But, you know, here's where your case falls on the spectrum, or here's good things about your case, here's bad things about your case, here's what sets it apart here or there. And, you know, because you're right, you always get the handicapping call. What are my odds of success? Well, you know, less than 50% if you're the appellant. So, you know, a lot less than that usually. But here's some more specific data that helps us with that.
Right.
Exactly. Right. And Pam's article is wonderful. We did not attempt to analyze Texas Supreme Court appeals. And one of the reasons was because Pam has that covered. Her work is really, really groundbreaking and really excellent in the Texas Supreme Court. I refer to it all the time.
It sounds like if we want to really nerd out on the statistical stuff, we should have Pam on the show, Jody.
We really should, honestly. We really ought to have her on here because her stuff about the Supreme Court statistics is always really interesting.
And I use our statistics now for some of the same purposes I would use hers for also, which is for settlement discussions that can really help a client figure out if they want to settle a case for a particular amount. And it also helps a lot of mediators we've heard keep a copy of the article around so that when someone goes in and says, well, I think there's a 90% chance that this judgment is going to be reversed, the mediator can pull down this article and say, well, you know.
A great tool. Yeah. Let me show you why the statistics say you're probably wrong.
You know, yeah,
that's awesome. Well, great. Well, Kent, this is really fantastic. I enjoy nerding out on this kind of stuff.
You know, absolutely.
Because it affects my practice day in, day out. I know Jody feels the same way. And, you know, I think it's great that you guys have updated this. The data trends, particularly what you observed following the changeover in the major metro area appellate benches, is very interesting. And I know our listeners are going to enjoy hearing about it. I've given them the site to the article. I'm sure we'll drop that down and include it in the show notes here so folks can find it easily.
Definitely.
And as we said, if people have a Texas Bar CLE subscription, they can probably get a lot of the same information out of some of the CLE articles that you and Natasha have written. We like to kind of wrap up with inviting our guests to share a tip or a war story, and you know, one that you can share publicly, because I know that, you know, as we were kind of chatting about before we started recording, sometimes there are those that you can't, but we'd love to hear from you on that.
Well, one that I can share publicly, definitely a high point of my appellate career, is I was on one of the programs, I think the Advanced Appellate course last year, the year before, maybe. Jody, you were on the same program. I'm not sure which one it was, but afterwards, an appellate justice came up to me and just started raving about how wonderful my presentation was and how it had, you know, really changed the way that this justice looked at things, and one of the greatest presentations. And as this justice was talking, I thought, some of this doesn't really seem to fit my presentation. And then the justice said, "So thanks so much, Jody, for speaking."
Well, I hadn't heard that before, but I appreciate the feedback. That's really funny.
You know, if Jody had been the one to ask the question about the war story, I would say, "Jody, you're being punked."
You would have thought it was a setup that maybe I'd send him an Amazon gift card before our Zoom call.
Right. I have to work on that from my end for the next show.
Hand on the Bible. Well, I'm glad. I guess I'd never gotten around to share that with you, Jody, but.
It's really funny.
That really happened.
Well, we look for opportunities for comic relief in appellate practice where we can find them, and that's a pretty good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. Jeez, I'm wondering what my topic was. I'm thinking about the things I've spoken about the last couple of years at that conference, and I wouldn't say any of them were life changing. But
they were for at least one judge.
Oh my goodness. Well, Kent, unless you had something else to add, I guess we can close it down. Again, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Thanks for this podcast. I think it's a wonderful thing that y'all are doing, and it's a great way for all of us to keep plugged into the appellate world, especially when we can't see each other in person. So a great time to launch the podcast, and I'm really enjoying it.
Well, good. Thanks so much. And thanks to our listeners for listening to this episode. If you're enjoying the podcast, please recommend it to colleagues you think might benefit from listening.
Taking the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts would be great too. We appreciate everyone who's rated us so far.
And if you have questions, thoughts, or comments, please shoot us an email, message us on Twitter, or reach out through the podcast Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Until next time, we wish you all the best and hope you're staying safe and healthy.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. To stay in touch with your hosts, suggest topics, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or on Twitter at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.